From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis join me today to discuss this week's national elections in Iraq and the growing ethnic tensions and violence in western China.
The Chinese government is saying that these are terrorists. They're even linking them to Al-Qaeda here recently. And the Uyghur are saying that we have cause.
And later, my conversation with historian and geographer Abigail Neely. Tuberculosis and HIV co-infection is one of sub-Saharan Africa's biggest health challenges, but she questions how closely they're related.
So when you have this whole pool of people with HIV and TB, and they're coughing in the presence of people who are poor but HIV negative, you notice an uptick in the passage of tuberculosis.
How poverty affects the immune system, coming up after the news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Joshua Landis, Rebecca Cruz, thank you for being here today. Iraq held parliamentary elections this week, and for the most part, these were relatively peaceful. This was somewhat surprising, given this was the first national election since all of the U.S. troops withdrew from Iraq. 60% turnout of the vote, lots of enthusiasm among many who turned out saying, you know, we're overcoming terrorism. We are taking revenge on the terrorists by casting our ballots. But are the Iraqis really ready to move on? Is this a step in the right direction? What are we to expect from this national election in Iraq?
Well, most analysts do not see this as a real step forward. Last elections, it took 9 months to form a government. Maliki, the prime minister, is not going to get a majority of votes, we don't believe, but he's going to spend a long time horse trading. But overall, the last several months have been marked by tremendous violence in the Sunni parts of Iraq. And as we recall, the prime minister is Shiite. 60% of the country is Shiite. And America went in there in order to displace the Sunnis, really, and help the Shiites to the top. But now the Sunnis are fighting again, and many have joined ISIS, this Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which is an Al-Qaeda, used to be Al-Qaeda affiliated, but was too violent even for Al-Qaeda. And there has been tremendous fighting, over 1,000 Iraqi soldiers killed fighting in the east. Just the other day, Iraq sent a whole column of Apache helicopters into Syria to shoot at these people who had taken hot pursuit into Syria. So there's a pall of violence over these elections, and there's lots of indecision. But on a, you know, on the larger picture,
I was going to say there are other elections coming up in the region,
elections.
And so I mean, is it just going to be more of the same?
I'm afraid we are going to see more of the same, because in Egypt, elections are coming up in May, and Sisi, the military ruler, is going to win. Syria, where 150,000 people have been killed, Assad is going to win, and boy, it's not looking bright.
So elections, maybe we're positive about that, but not so positive about the outcome. It's not going to change anything, right? Is this what you're telling us, Joshua?
Unfortunately, I don't think so.
All right, Rebecca, off to another part of the world, China. Interesting increase in violent attacks in the western part of China, particularly in large public settings, train stations, assailants coming in with knives and explosives and killing a few, injuring a lot. This seems to be reflective of ethnic tensions going on out there in the western part of China, separatist groups. What are we to make of this growing violence in this region of China?
Well, as you said, this has been going on for some time. But here this week, we heard of the latest attack again at a train station where 3 people were killed and about 80 or so were potentially wounded. This happened right after the president was in the area, actually there to talk about terrorism, anti-terrorism steps that his government has taken. Of course, we remember the president has only been in power since last year, so about a year and a half. And it was very important for his policies to be pronounced in this area and for him to stand very firm on this. We don't exactly know who's responsible for the attack this week. We do have some ideas, but of course it is Chinese media, and so we're getting very specific messages. Blogs have been blocked, other things are going on. But what it looks like is happening is that we're talking about the Uyghur population, which is a group of Turkish Muslims in that area, and that they have been involved in many of these activities. The activity earlier this year in March with the stabbing at the train station, which we talked about on the show, is also thought to have been perpetrated by them. But they are seeking, or some of them, are seeking separatism. They're seeking their own country, similar perhaps to Tibet. There's about 45% of the population in this area in the northeast there is Uyghur. And for about the last 20 or 25 years, we're seeing growing tensions between these groups. The Chinese government has made a policy of sending in Han Chinese to populate the area, and this is increasing the strife between the two. We also saw a lot during the lead up to the Olympics as well.
Just to be fair, though, I mean, I guess their argument is that they are being oppressed by the Han ethnic group, or the Chinese majority. The Chinese government is repressing the Uyghur population, trying to prevent them from being able to use their languages and their own cultural practices, you know, that they don't have their they aren't allowed to have their cultural identity. And so this is their response, is they want to separate themselves, obviously, from China. Is this the situation here? So there's, in other words, their violent response is in response to this repression that they say
right.
they're suffering
from. That is the argument. The Chinese government is saying that these are terrorists. They're even linking them to Al-Qaeda here recently. And the Uyghur are saying that we have cause, that we have been mistreated, that there was violence perpetrated against us, and that the Chinese government is using them essentially as a scapegoat. We have no idea that these are the people that perpetrated this crime, but obviously already China is saying that it is. And so perhaps the Chinese government is over-exaggerating the claims to make the situation look more dire than it is. We don't know. We aren't getting the information.
Well, another issue to continue to watch. Thank you so much, Rebecca and Joshua, for being here with me this week.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
If you have a question for me or any of our panelists, let us know in the Worldview section of our website, kgou.org. We're also on Twitter, @WorldviewsKGOU. Or you can contact each of us individually, @SuzetteGrelot, @Cruz226, and @Joshua_Landis. Coming up, I'll talk with University of Minnesota historian and geographer Abigail Neely. She's currently serving as a resident fellow at Yale University and working on a book about health and the environment in South Africa. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Today, I'm joined by Yale resident fellow and University of Minnesota professor Abigail Neely. She studies interactions between residents and local government in South Africa and how the population's health issues shape state policy. She's working on a book based on her dissertation called Witchcraft and Wellness, documenting the changing relationships between health and the environment in South Africa between the 1930s and 80s. Abigail Neely, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Now, we know that there's this connection between health and the environment, but can you just tell us kind of in general, what are the primary health concerns that are related to the environment and environmental issues that affect health? Just kind of give us the context here.
Sure. So I do my research in a rural area of South Africa called Pulela, which is a Zulu-speaking area in the mountains. And the reason I'm orienting us there, it's sort of on the southern border of Lesotho, and I'm orienting us there because it's a place that is high in the mountains, and so it has very cold winters, which means that the relationships between health and environment are different than we often think about in Africa. And so what I mean by that is that there isn't malaria. There's no vector-borne illnesses, no mosquitoes that bear illness, and there's no water-borne illnesses either. So the streams are cold enough, and so the water sources, and they're protected, and so people aren't getting sick in the ways we often think about health and environment in rural spaces. And so the research that I do, it looks at the middle of the 20th century. And so it follows two different strands of relationships between health and environment. The first is through nutrition. And so I look at agricultural practices and in particular gardening practices So small home kitchen gardens, and then the food that people eat and the particular sort of nutrients in that food. So thinking about vitamin A, iron, all these sorts of things. And micronutrients are really important in people's health for ensuring that cellular processes function. So macronutrients, protein, carbohydrates, things like that, build our cells. And then micronutrients make sure that they do the things they're supposed to do. Our immune system, which fights off illness, works as it should. And in this area, gardening was particularly important. And gardening was introduced by a community health center in the 40s and 50s. They introduced particular techniques, scientific gardening techniques, as well as particularly nutritious foods, things like beetroot and carrots and other nutritious vegetables. And the other one I look at is a local healing or protection ritual in which families would hire an isangoma. An isangoma is a healer who heals in consultation with their ancestors. And that healer comes and protects their homes. So the homesteads are sort of demarcated in the landscape. You can see the edges of them. So protects the home and the people who live in it, so the family members. The kraal, a kraal is a livestock enclosure. So the kraal and the animals that sleep in it, mainly cows, and then fields and the crops that grow in them. And this healer is protecting these spaces and the crops or people or animals that inhabit them from illness or misfortune due to witchcraft and weather. And so you can see here that this is a radically different way to understand health and environment, but health and environment are deeply intertwined in this way as well as through nutrition. And so my work really tries to think through the ways in which people get sick and the environment shapes the ways in which people get sick and the ways in which they get better or protect themselves against ill health. Because in some senses, the gardening and the doctors at this health center even articulated it this way. The gardening project was in many ways a health protection program. So to protect people, thinking about nutrition as the baseline of good health, to protect people against ill health, that's part of that gardening program, similarly to what the Isangoma was doing.
Well, this is truly very fascinating and different, as you mentioned, than the way we typically think of kind of health and the environment coming together. But it sounds like you're kind of bringing together some very different disciplines here, some kind of medical anthropology and geography. I mean, you're a geographer, right?
Yes.
So but bringing in kind of this medical, anthropological, cultural connection between that and place and kind of what the geographical place is providing and how that connects to the culture. Is that kind of
yeah,
the approach you're taking here?
Absolutely. I think in either of these frames of understanding, place is essential. So the home garden as a place where you can sort of see nutrition growing, right? And then places as protected in particular ways by healers. Both of these are essential. And so I would say in addition, absolutely, the work touches in medical anthropology or in Africanist anthropology, geography, but it also touches in sort of Africanist history. And then even borrowing a lot of ideas from biomedical science. You know, I take a lot of inspiration, and also I borrow a lot of ideas about the ways in which, you know, vitamin A literally helps you see better if you have enough of it, or the ways in which tuberculosis, for instance, affects the bacteria's effect your immune system cells, those sorts of things. So it sort of borrows from a bunch of these different places to try to make sense of the world, because I in many ways think the world is complicated. So we need lots of disciplines to understand what's happening.
My guest is Abigail Neely, a historical geographer whose research focuses on the relationship between human health, cultural practices, and the mediating effects of culture and government policy. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest today is University of Minnesota historical geographer and Yale resident fellow, Abigail Neely. When we left off, she described how her work combines anthropology, geography, and history to understand things like how tuberculosis bacteria affect immune system cells. Let's talk about tuberculosis, since you mentioned it. Some of the work that you've been doing is kind of studying the connection between HIV/AIDS and tuberculosis. How are these things connected, and how can we understand one? Can we understand one in absence of the other in the places that you've studied in Africa?
So if we fast forward now to roughly the present moment, a lot of people who think about tuberculosis or AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa recognize that TB-HIV co-infection is one of the biggest health challenges. And so the reason that people think about this is that HIV, which is a virus. What it does is it affects – it's a retrovirus. It enters people's cells. It basically breaks down the immune system. The immune system is what we use to fight off infection. And so what it does is it makes it so it's hard for you to fight off infection, meaning that you can get all sorts of illnesses. Tuberculosis has for a long time been fairly common in South Africa. And as a result of that, people are contracting tuberculosis in much higher numbers because their immune systems can't fight it off. There's lots of people with tuberculosis around them, and so they're getting it. This is important in South Africa for another reason, because it's the largest killer right now. So tuberculosis, with usually in combination with HIV, is the largest killer in the country right now. So that's the way that it's often constructed or explained, articulated. And that's a really, really important way to understand the relationships between HIV and TB. The work that I've been doing tries to question that sort of tight coupling of the relationship between tuberculosis and HIV. And so the way that I do that is to think about the ways in which tuberculosis passes. So it's, let's say it's biology, the ways it affects people's immune systems, the ways HIV works, what HIV looks like in immune systems, the other ways in which people achieve immune compromise, and sort of trying to think – or have immune compromise. Achieve is not the right word, but have immune compromise, and try to think about what it would be like if we understood TB and HIV to be uncoupled. So if we started to try to think about people who have tuberculosis in South Africa but don't have HIV. And so the way that I think about this is – HIV is absolutely the place where I do research. The rates for HIV are over 30%. So that's a huge amount of the population. So with that amount of the population, that's a bunch of people who have immunocompromised. So they can't fight off infection. Many of them have tuberculosis. Huge numbers of them have tuberculosis, which means that tuberculosis is all over. People pass tuberculosis by coughing or talking or singing or sneezing. And tuberculosis, which is a bacteria, lodges in your saliva, let's say, and you sort of cough and it comes out, and somebody next near you can breathe it in, and then they can contract tuberculosis. There's three things that happen. Sometimes their immune system fights it off, so it doesn't happen. Sometimes it lodges in their body, but they don't become actively sick. And then sometimes it'll lodge in their body and they become actively sick. So they cough, they have night sweats, all the sorts of things of tuberculosis. And so the fact that there are so many HIV positive people who also have TB means that there is TB all over the place. At the same time that that's happening, there's a whole bunch of people who are poor, and lots of people have shown that poverty causes immune compromise. So poor people literally aren't as well nourished. They don't have enough micro and macronutrients, as I was talking about before, so they can't fight off infections or other sorts of things like that. And so they're sort of immunocompromised. So when you have this whole pool of people with HIV and TB, and they're coughing all over the place, and they're coughing in the presence of people who are poor but HIV negative, you notice an uptick in the passage of tuberculosis. And so part of what I've been working on and trying to think through is what would happen if we imagined that HIV was impacting the health of people who are HIV negative. Because we normally think of HIV as this terrible disease that deteriorates people's immune systems and makes them susceptible to all sorts of infections. Beyond tuberculosis, there's cancers and there's pneumonia and things like that, and that's what kills them. So, but there are these infectious diseases that now are much more common even when people are HIV negative. And so trying to think about HIV as having an impact in a much broader way is a lot of what that work is sort of trying to think through.
So your latest project then is titled, very interestingly, Witchcraft and Wellness, Agency and Change in 20th Century Africa. So now that you've demonstrated this kind of, I don't want to say link to, I guess this unlinking, I guess this decoupling, as you mentioned, of HIV and AIDS and how HIV AIDS actually has an impact on non-infected individuals, does this come back around to this notion of healing, and how is it related to that? Or what does your Witchcraft and Wellness project focus on?
So the Witchcraft and Wellness project finishes, that's a book that I'm finishing, and that finishes in the 1980s. So that's pre-HIV/AIDS epidemic. But one of the ways in which it connects is that in the 1940s and 50s, in this area where I do my research, the government started a community health center called the Palela Community Health Center. And it was a model of social medicine. And so the social medicine model was to pay attention to not only what made people sick, so say tuberculosis, because people had it then, or a lack of protein or something like that that causes an illness called kwashiorkor. But it was to pay attention to why these people got sick in the first place. So thinking about poverty, education, a lack of knowledge about what makes people sick, poor hygiene, those sorts of questions. And so this health center started a model where they would go out and they would visit people's homesteads to teach them about nutrition or other health education. They would help them build healthier gardens. They would help protect water sources. They would do all these sorts of things. And they would also work to get people employed. They would work to make particular things available, things that we don't think of as necessarily health-related, but say powdered milk. So powdered milk has a lot of protein. They would work to get local shops to stock them so people could buy it and eat it. And it was all about educating people and helping people sort of understand and work in ways that they could be healthier. And so what's interesting about this model is that it looked at people as whole people, right? So it looked at them as people who could get sick and people who could get healthy in multiple different ways. And so in many ways, that's a model that the health system today could use. So the health system in South Africa tends to treat, because of the ways in which HIV/AIDS gets funded, tends to treat it as a sort of separate illness from tuberculosis, from primary care. And this model that was implemented in this place said, no, that's not the way health works. People's lives are sort of messy, let's say, that all these sorts of things are interconnected. So we need to treat the whole person. And I think recognize, and we need to treat not only the whole person, but their family and then their community. So the interventions were usually at household and community scales. And I think that sort of logic could really recognize HIV as a broader problem and help intervene in positive and productive ways to make people healthier.
Okay, so what you're saying then is we've got this model then that you can develop and migrate to other communities and make an impact on health and wellness in general.
Absolutely. Africa. So it's a model that was sort of abandoned in the 1960s, but it's a model that we could bring back. It's a different vision of healthcare. And the book more broadly that looks at witchcraft as well says that this isn't a sufficient vision of healthcare. There's other ways of understanding health. But when we're talking specifically about HIV/AIDS and its health impacts, its tuberculosis impacts, absolutely, this model could do wonders for sort of thinking and treating people.
Well, Abby, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Abigail Neely, who studies the intersection of health, cultural practices, and government policy in South Africa. There's more information and a link to her work on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Nick Aguilera prepares our web content, and the program is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Corlott.